Tokyo Podcast episode number 22.
On this episode of Tokyo Podcast, we go inside the Japanese Yakuza with Belgian photographer Anton Custers, and I buy the coolest stapler known to mankind. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, we're going to be talking about the Yakuza. As you know, the Yakuza is the Japanese mafia, the organized crime. And on today's show, we're going to be talking to a photographer named Anton Custers, who spent 2 years photographing the Yakuza. Unbelievably, he convinced the Yakuza to allow him to come into their lives and document their daily activities, and he spent 2 years doing it and produced an amazing photography book detailing the lives of this one particular Yakuza clan. So it's a fascinating look into the secret life of the Yakuza, and I'll be talking to him a little bit later on in the show. Before we get into today's show, I want to talk about my new stapleless stapler. That's right. My week this week was so exciting. The coolest thing that happened to me was my new stapleless stapler that I bought from a website called flutterscape.com. And this stapler is made by a company called Harinax, something like that. And anyways, it's a really neat kind of mechanism that they use here where they don't use metal staplers to staple the pages together. It operates just like a regular stapler. You put the papers in the slot, but what happens is it punches two holes in the paper and then pushes the paper from the first hole into the second hole. It's a little bit complex to describe, but if you go on YouTube and just search for stapleless stapler, you will see videos of it, and it's actually a really ingeniously designed little product. It saves you the hassle of having to buy metal staplers, and I'm surprised at how strongly it holds the paper together. So kind of a fun little thing that I picked up, and I actually bought this from a website called Flutterscape, and this is a fun little website where... Have you ever found stuff on YouTube or on the web or something that's in Japan that you just know you have to have, like my stapleless stapler, but trying to order it from Japan is a nightmare because if you don't read Japanese, the website, you can't figure it out, and you're worried about shipping and all that other kind of stuff. But this website, what they do is you can order it from this website and they will go purchase it for you and ship it to you. And they've got just tons of stuff from electronics to fashion to anime, manga, whatever. They've got it on here. So it's a fun little way to shop for stuff. I mean, I shop for it. I'm in Japan. It's just so much easier because their whole website's in English. But if you live in America, if you live in Europe and you want to buy stuff in Japan, definitely check out flutterscape.com because they make shopping in Japan for really cool stuff like my stapleless stapler a lot easier. Time for this week's segment of Japan Blog News, and joining me once again is Sophie from Sophie's Japan Blog website. Hey Sophie, what do you have for us this week?
Hi, I've got two websites this week. One is a bento blog, and the other is a slightly unusual comic-type blog. It's first one is called Life in Japan, and this is a blog that we're both very fond of this week. It's pretty unique, and it's written by a man called Victor Edison. He's living in Japan and he's currently teaching English. This is basically a comic about his daily life in Japan. He's got a baby son called Ken, and a lot of these short panel comics are about him raising him. The art's very charming, and there's a new comic every few days. They're actually drawn in advance, so they come online about a month behind real time.
Yeah, what I particularly liked about his blog is there's many Life in Japan blogs, and they're not, you know, uncommon here. But he's taking a unique way of showcasing his life by drawing a comic strip every day of what his life is like. And I find that fascinating because, I mean, it's hard enough to maintain a blog and maintain regular postings just by writing it. But the fact that he's able to draw a comic every day, I think is impressive. And his comics are rather cute and rather fun to look at. So
yeah, And I think obviously with readers, it's easier to look at a short comic rather than necessarily read through a big blog post. So I think that's one of the big attractions for it.
Yeah, definitely. So I recommend people check that out. It's lifeinjapan-comic.blogspot.com. And what's the second one you have?
The second one is called cookinggallery.blogspot.com. This is another blog I'd like to share this week. It's one that I've linked to my blog in the past. It's in the author's own words, this blog is a personal culinary journal by a 20-something-year-old girl who loves cooking, cake decorating, and making cute bento. It's regularly updated with complete bento recipes that you can easily make yourself at home. There are many great bento blogs on the internet, but this is one of my favourites, mainly because she seems to be combining. She's not just making bento, she's experimenting.
Yeah, I like how she makes little pigs from cherry tomatoes.
Yeah.
So I think if it'd be kind of fun to go to the office and pop out one of these bento boxes. I mean, they're like little works of art.
They really are. They are very impressive.
Yeah, so if you're interested in finding out different ways of making bento, check out her website. And her website is what? It's cookinggallery.blogspot.com. Japan is one of the safest countries in the world to live in, but that doesn't mean the country doesn't have its share of organized crime. The Yakuza, as they are known in Japan, is an organized crime group made up of 2,500 different families with an estimated 83,000 members. Their history goes as far back as the Edo period in Japan, and they follow a centuries-old code called the Bushido. They are estimated to control a business empire to generate over $242 billion a year in revenue, and are said to have influence in many parts of Japanese culture, including entertainment, politics, and business. My guest today is Anton Custers, who spent 2 years photographing the life of a Tokyo Yakuza gang, and is one of the first Westerners ever to be granted access to the Yakuza. His book, Odo Yakuza Tokyo, is a personal account of his life inside this hidden subculture of Japan. Welcome to the show, Anton.
Hey, Anthony. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you for joining me. I remember seeing kind of snippets of your book when it originally came out. And I was very excited to kind of try to get a copy, but it sold out remarkably fast. And so I'm really glad you're doing a second printing.
I'm glad too. I mean, I just had to give in to popular demand. I mean, it was like 30 days after I launched the book that it was sold out, the limited edition version. And people just kept on emailing me. I got so much press attention, for which I'm so grateful. And that it just, you know, pushed me onto making a second print run of the book. And a general edition, which is now for sale, and that is that made the world of difference.
Right. Well, take us back a little bit, if you can. Like, what made you decide to take on this project?
Actually, the reason for the project was remarkably, how would you say, small and emotional. Basically, my brother has been living in Japan for many years now, and I actually miss him, and we were looking for reasons so that I could more often come to Japan and pay him a visit, especially since the birth of his first child and, you know, things like that. And once, you know, in Kabukicho, in the red light district of Tokyo, we were sitting in a little bar discussing, you know, what we could do to make it possible for me to travel more to Japan, to have a reason. When a Yakuza member walked into the bar, and obviously if you've ever seen a Yakuza member, it's not like they look really, really, different from anyone else. They just look very, very well dressed and very well behaved, because that's the kind of, message they want to send out. So there was this really well dressed man walking into the bar, speaking a few words with a bartender and then leaving immediately. And we just thought, like, who's this? And the bartender, who's a friend of us, Taka-san, he told us at that point, oh, that is a real Yakuza member. And so my brother and I looked at each other and said, like, I think we might have a project here. Let's see if we can pursue this in some way.
At that point, did you kind of really understand what you were trying to get into? I mean, this is a severely closed world to foreigners. Yeah. And the idea of bringing not only yourselves in there, but a camera.
We had no idea. I mean, the only thing I knew about the Yakuza were the movies, you know, the American movies which portray them, well, you know, in a sensationalist way, you know, right. Like Kill Bill or something like that.
Right.
So that's all we actually knew. And Taka-san took it upon him to sit us down and you know, tell us, like, look, it's not what you think. This is really, how would you say, you have to really think of it in a very serious way. These are serious people. It is really, they're really criminals. It's not like in the movies. It is real. So if you want me to, you know, if you want to pursue this, you have to be committed to actually want to do this. They will notice if you try to get in. I mean, you obviously can't just get in. You have to negotiate your way in. But if you're negotiating, they have to see that you are really after what you say that you're after. So your intentions have to be open and true. And that's what, you know, set us off to think about it a bit more seriously. And then he added to it. Taka-san added to it. If you are really serious about this, I can bring you in contact with Soichiro, who is the guy who just walked into the bar, and I can bring you to the table with him, but you will have to negotiate your own way in. But the fact that I do this is me putting my life at stake for you. So please, you know, do not take this lightly.
Wow.
So that's when we decided to start doing it.
Sorry, what was that discussion like between you and your brother? Because you obviously must have thought, you know, if you guys somehow mess this up, not only are you putting you and your brother's life in danger, but you're putting other people's lives in danger. What kind of prompted you guys to make the final decision to say, okay, let's go ahead with this?
Well, basically, we just told each other we would be completely open towards them during negotiations, as to what our intentions were, you know, photographing and following them. And we promised to always keep each other in the loop and always discuss with Taka whatever was going on. Is it the right thing to do? What do we have to do? Stuff like that. So that we definitely, I mean, it is a burden, but in a positive way, it is a burden on your shoulders to know that you are responsible for your actions in a more direct way than you would be how would you say, going to work in the morning or something like that.
Right. It's amazing to me, you know, the amount of foreigners I've talked to here and how they struggle to conform to Japanese society because there's so many social rules. Just going to work and, you know, just which side of the escalator to stand on.
Yeah.
And I mean, the consequences of making a mistake in that is nothing. You get in someone's way or you don't say the right word. But in your case, a mistake in social faux pas could be a huge deal, could end up costing you your life.
Indeed. It would, in our case, it would, I think, unless we would really have malintent, it wouldn't cost us or literally our life, but, it would definitely not be a pleasant experience. So it was one of the most important things that I had to go through was, both Taka-san and Soichiro, once the decision was made, because we'd negotiated for about 10 months before we actually got an approval. But once the approval was made, it took them about 6 months, both of them combined, to teach me manners in a way. And any Japanese person will know what I'm talking about because I'm a Westerner. In the eyes of the Yakuza, I am like a bull in a porcelain shop. I don't know anything about social interactions. I don't know anything about the intricacies. I don't know anything about behaving myself and stuff like that. So I had to be led and teached how to, you know, how to understand and at least not make the gravest mistakes.
Right, right. And so you said this negotiation took 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
When you initially approached the Yakuza, what was their reaction?
Well, they obviously, the first thing they think is, well, we've got a lot to do and you've got a lot to do. So why would we spend time with you?
Right.
But the lucky part was that Soichiro is a bit open towards foreigners and is open to learning about other cultures in general. And we concentrated on talking about, not about photography, in general, but more about learning Japanese culture in general and learning Yakuza culture specifically. And in turn, he would also learn through our interaction about, you know, Western culture and Western ways. And that to him, the interesting cultural exchange was a very important thing to know. And on top of that, obviously, we had to make him understand that, both Malik and I, both my brother and I were European. Or are European and not American. So we are not, you know, a lot of Japanese use the word gaijin, but they use it in a derogatory way. And most often they actually mean Americans, because right. Americans are, or American people are not very not very sensitive to other cultures, towards other cultures. And Europeans do have that sensitivity, and trying to explain that difference towards Soichiro made a very big difference. So the fact that I knew that I wasn't behaving, but that I was willing to learn how to behave and willing to undergo and willing to take my time, to do that, made all the difference in the world towards him.
Wow.
And yeah, the pictures were basically a byproduct from that moment onwards, but obviously, of course, became more important the longer the project progressed.
Were they concerned at all that you were with law enforcement or anything like that?
Not at all, actually, because it's pretty simple. In this case, it was pretty simple for them to know, because I was a Westerner. So right. They knew I couldn't be Japanese police at all. And international, like Interpol and stuff like that, there is nothing for them to worry about as long as they remain in Japan. So that wasn't really a concern for them.
So their privacy wasn't a concern? Like, you would kind of think that organized crime and a journalistic photographer don't really go together, because you think that one group wants privacy and the other one's trying to invade it. So, but so I'm surprised to see in your photos, so many of them have their faces exposed, and that wasn't a concern for them?
It wasn't a concern, in partly because I have a very specific way of working. Also to say, I'm not a journalist in any way, so I didn't approach this journalistically. I didn't do any research whatsoever. And, my intention towards them, which was all came up during the negotiations, was to make, an arts project, a book, an exhibition, and tell my story like I experience it as a Westerner with an open mind. But I don't have any, opinions about the Yakuza in specific. Obviously I have opinions about violence and things like that, which I don't condone in any way, but they know that. To get back to the points, I have a very specific way of working, especially because it's a long-term project. I try to take them along with the story that I am experiencing. So what I tell them is, every picture that I take, you will see afterwards, and you will see it, and you will be able to veto every picture or any picture that you feel that is not fit, or that you feel is too revealing, or for whatever reason. You don't even need to give a reason. And at the same time, any picture that you would push forward, I can also veto. So right from the start, they immediately knew that they had the power, if they wouldn't feel comfortable, to stop anything at any time. And they would know also that they would not have the power to make me become a propaganda machine, you know, right. The other extreme.
So more of a collaboration.
Yes. So immediately they would see like, okay, Anton, Soichiro, we are both at the same level here. We both want to achieve something, and nobody can pressure, one or the other into doing something they would not want. And that was also, of course, very important to them. But, you would think, of course, because I know what I'm doing, obviously, as a photographer, you would think, that I would be giving up control in some way. But, I can tell you that over the course of those 2 years of photographing and all the images that I showed them, you know, every couple of weeks I would, sit together with them and show them, the images that had been made. They never, ever, disapproved of any image in the course of those whole 2 years. So it goes to show that seemingly giving up control is actually not giving up control. It's finding a good way to collaborate and to both get to your goals.
That's interesting. That's fascinating that they didn't veto any of the photographs.
Yeah, indeed. And obviously, I mean, you can also see from the book that I didn't experience, photograph actual criminal acts like, for example, a murder or a beating or something like that.
Right.
But that is, partly they would say that it would be for my safety that I shouldn't be privy to that. And, I wouldn't want to be that either, because I would not be able to remain neutral if I would see something like that happening in front of me, because I would want to intervene, of course, and say, look, I mean, don't do these kind of things.
Were you ever worried about your own personal safety?
Not in regards to the photographic project, but yes, in regards to what we talked about earlier about behaving well and stuff like that, because as everyone knows, it's so crucial in Japanese society. It is even more so very crucial in Yakuza circles. So it was really very hard to constantly be aware of my surroundings, and to constantly, you know, make sure that I did not make any mistakes. And once in a while, I was reminded of the fact that, like, if I would make, you know, a grave mistake and they would see, that it would be, how would you say, malintent, that it would be Taka who would first, be punished, right, and then my brother, and then only myself. So, I mean, that was in and of itself the biggest motivation to, you know, to really, take everything seriously.
Can you tell us just briefly, because I'm really fascinated about this aspect of Japanese culture in general, just this adherence to these unspoken rules that the Japanese all seem to know. And yet, foreigners, we just never seem to kind of figure it out. And so can you tell us, what were some of the training that Taka-san gave you and told you about how to act and when, what to do?
It were things that were hard to understand for me as well. I mean, some of the things I don't even understand why, right now, but, it would be, for example, simple things like, okay, you have to know the order in the family. And when you enter a room, you have to say, good morning or yoroshiku onegaishimasu, to the right person, at the right moment. And you have to say, something else to another person at a different moment. So you have to, basically, if you walk in the room, first you go to Socho, who's the godfather. Then you go to Kaicho, and then you go to, the third in line, the fourth in line, the fifth in line. And you, to each of those people, you say also a different phrase, as a way of greeting them and stuff like that. So knowing those things took quite a while. Also because, you know, simply because as a Westerner, it's hard for me to recognize Japanese people, for example. It would take me a couple of weeks before I could recognize the Godfather and know who he is, if you know what I'm saying.
Right.
If I would see him randomly, because if I would bump into him, I would have to, you know, say hello in the appropriate way as well.
Right.
But, you know, in order for that to happen, I would have to, you know, obviously be able to recognize him. And it's not like he walks around with a big name tag, I am the Godfather.
Right.
So, so, you know, those kind of things were really hard. And also, but also the other way around, for example, once I was accepted into the family as being allowed to photograph them, they also encouraged me to actually be the photographer and to actually be very forward coming and be, how would you say, very confident, or look very confident and act very confident. So don't just, you know, sit there very quiet in a corner. But when you see a picture happening, they would tell me, you know, stand up and go and make that picture, because they would expect me to make good pictures, and they would feel very offended if they were the reason why I would be afraid to take pictures. Especially after they would have given me permission to take pictures,
right,
if you understand what I mean.
Right.
So they actually turned it around and teach me that way. Like, look, everybody thinks now that you are going to take pictures. So, you know, you have to do it as well. So don't stand back.
Right. So you had kind of a dichotomy. You had two sides. One, you're trying to be polite and understanding of the situation. But then on the other side, they're encouraging you to be the photographer that they allowed you to come in.
Yeah. And they would encourage me to, for example, be upset if somebody of the family, and verbally be angry if somebody of the family would not allow me to take pictures, because the Godfather had said I was allowed to take pictures. So I was, you know, in my rights, which is a very weird thing, because you constantly think like, okay, this is the Yakuza. I'm scared. I mean, they can hurt me. They know where I live, everything. But at the same time, you have to be able to take this other position, which is, you know, something completely new to me and which is, I think, unique to Japanese society.
Yeah, I think Japanese society, no matter, you know, Yakuza or not Yakuza, they respect professionalism.
Yeah, something like that.
And
yeah.
So they, you know, they granted you this access because they recognize professionalism in you. And so they expect you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if it means getting the shot and yelling at someone, they expect you to do that as well.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
I can understand your position, though. It'd be difficult to, because I mean, what if you misrecognize someone and you ended up yelling at the Godfather?
For example, yeah. which, if I were to yell at him for the right reason, it would be completely accepted.
But
obviously, I would have to be able to discern, like, is it the right reason or is it not the right reason? And for that, I needed, obviously, Soichiro to give me as much guidance as possible. And obviously, he did a great job, because at the same time, he was internally within the family responsible for my behaving.
And how long were you photographing this Yakuza family?
It was exactly 2 years. I think, around about exactly 2 years. So it was about 10 months negotiations. And then it took them, the moment that they said okay, it was, I think, in November 2008. Then they asked me the courtesy of waiting for about 6 months so that they could tell everyone within the family that, you know, I was going to be there, to prevent the shoot first, asking questions later kind of situations. So obviously I kindly obliged to that. And in April 2009, I actually started photographing, and that lasted for 2 years until April 2011, which is about 6-7 months ago. And that's when I actually, you know, also started laying final hands on the book and things like that.
Right. And what was the process like when did you follow one particular guy around for 2 years, or or how did that work?
Actually, we concentrated on the family, and we used Soichiro, who was our contact, who we negotiated with, and who actually, you know, was my kind of my chaperone in a way, or my fixer. Well, Taka was the actual fixer because he doesn't belong to the Yakuza, but Soichiro told us the ways that we could get the best access in the best possible way. So he would give us as much as possible inside information and would say, for example, oh, this guy is really interesting because he's a street fighter. This guy is interesting because he is, well, the godfather, obviously. This guy is interesting because of this reason. And the best way to approach him would to do it, you know, this way and that way. So he would be working half with us, half within the Yakuza to get what we actually wanted to do. So we followed multiple persons, and obviously I started concentrating more and more on Gaicho, who is, you know, not the real godfather of the family, but the actual day-to-day big boss, who makes everything happen and who is, you know, the second most important person of the entire family.
And how did that work? Did they phone you and say, we're going to be at this location? Or did you live with them, or how did that process work?
What actually happened is it was kind of, you would almost call it, picture by appointment. So, what actually would happen is my brother, because I don't speak Japanese, my brother speaks fluently Japanese. He would be the constant negotiator, and he would constantly, together with Soichiro, determine an agenda for the next couple of months. So Ichiro would, for example, say, okay, this happened now, another family took over, a part of our property, and now we have to do this, and then this will happen, and this will happen then, and this will happen, you know, right about then, and then there's a golf tournament, and then there's a commemoration, and our covert training camp is happening in that weekend, and that week, for those days, and then we would kind of set an agenda and say, okay, so the month of July and August is an interesting month that Anton could stay with you guys, and I would, you know, come over, stay with them for the month of July and August. At the end of August, I would show them all the pictures, and then I would go back to Belgium for a week or two, and then the cycle would start again, you know, from September to November or something like that, and it would go on every time for 1, 2, 3 months at a time.
When you were in the midst of them, photographing them when they're at, a golf tournament, mm-hmm. or some activity, mm-hmm. did you feel tension from the other members? Or over time, were you kind of, did you feel a camaraderie? Did they kind of say, hey, Anton's here, great. Or were they always a little bit kind of suspicious, uh-huh. as to who this gaijin with the camera was?
Yeah, it was, it's kind of like in real life. So it's kind of like a cross section of real life. So you would, if you would imagine that you meet 10 or 20 friends, new people at once, you would after a while get to know some people better, and some people would keep their distance, and some people you would never really trust, and some people you would get some kind of a bond with, you know. So it kind of went like a natural getting to know each other thing. There were definitely many people whom I was very, very weary of and who I wouldn't trust being alone with, some people who would feel really uncomfortable if I would photograph them, but they would obviously always let me photograph them, right. because that were the rules laid out by the Godfather. And some right. people who would really, when they would see me again, say, hey, Anton, how are you? Long time no see. Because obviously in their eyes, I am somebody exotic as well. You know, I'm a Westerner with a camera. It's also something they don't see that often. So they would be interested in what my life was as much as I would be interested in them. So that was a good, back and forth basis to get deeper in there and to get into situations which for example, in the beginning weeks, I would not have been able to get into.
What surprised you about the Yakuza? Like, what were your thoughts about them before this project? And what were your thoughts after?
What actually surprised me is two things. One is the subtlety of everything. I always thought it would be more very overt and very macho, machismo, you know, like the Italian mafia or like the Mexican drug cartels, you know, right. Walking around with guns and, you know, shouting, I am the boss. So that was one thing that really, really, surprised me, that everything was very subtle and unoutspoken, to put it like that, or unspoken. And the other thing that surprised me was that, almost everyone within the Yakuza regards the Yakuza for them as a way of life and not as being someone, you know, not as their actions, but not that their actions define them, but that their way of life actually defines them. So they would not only, how would you say, what I would think is, well, the Yakuza is a criminal organization and they go out and do violent things. But actually they believe themselves that they have a way of life and that they hold up some kind of code of honor. And that code of honor, for them, if necessary, brings violence forth. If they want to keep their honor and they need to do something violent to keep that, they will obviously not hesitate to do that. But at the same time, when they want to do what we would consider as outsiders, you know, quote unquote, good things, and that would not have violence needed to do those things, then that would not have violence needed to do those things. So, you know, they would kind of, for example, like in the great earthquake of Kobe so many years ago, or now with the tsunami in Sendai and stuff like that, you would see that they would be helping as well, right. Which is for us outsiders a very, very weird and very sour tasting thing, you know, somebody who is a known criminal does something good at the same time is something that ethically is very, very hard to comprehend and very hard to condone. Right. But it is something that they do, and it is a reality. So they know very well that what they do, when they do something, that it is good or that it is bad. I mean, they're not just, you know, simple thugs. So they know that what they are doing has a specific purpose of gaining more power in society or getting rooted more in society or defending themselves in a way that makes it harder for the police to prosecute or persecute them.
Did you get any sense at all of how they feel about the police? And especially about kind of the recent crackdown in Yakuza activity?
Well, they know that the police, kind of is the boss, you can see that the crackdown, I mean, they can crack down on the Yakuza if they want to and if they find the right way and the right time to do it. Obviously the Yakuza and the police are connected in some way, but not like criminally connected or officially connected. I mean, it's what Soichiro told me once is from all the youth, and it's a very cryptic description, but it's a very good description, which actually a good listener can read between the lines there. And what he told me was that in the lost youth of Japan, which, you know, after they, went to school and don't see a future, anymore. They don't want to study. They don't want to work or they don't, you know, they don't really, have a good guidance, or they don't feel like they have a good guidance in this world. 50% of those people become Yakuza and 50% of those people become police.
Right.
And when you hear somebody like Suichiro say that, then you actually know how deep the Yakuza in society actually is in Japan. And you cannot just say, well, let's get rid of them, because that just, you know, doesn't work. Because the friends that grew up together, 50% of them is Yakuza and 50% of them is police. You know that sometimes, the police will keep an eye shut and say, okay, when you behave yourself within these limits, I will not crack down upon you. And the other way around as well, the Yakuza will also not, openly, how would you say, commit violence against the police or against what they would call innocent people, people who are not members of any criminal organizations.
Right. One thing I'm kind of curious about is, did you encounter or have any interactions at all with women Yakuza members?
Yeah, I think I only once or twice, well, in the family that I followed, I did not see any women as being part of the organization, you know, as being a boss or something like that. Right. And I asked Soichiro about it, and he said, generally speaking, there are no women in the Yakuza, at least not in significant places. Let's put it that way.
Right.
So I can't really comment much about being or seeing women. I only saw women in the role of, what the Yakuza was actually doing. Like, for example, the family that I followed was very much into, the clubs and, the sex clubs and the hostess bars. Yes, that's the one.
Right.
So in that respect, there would be a lot of women around, but there would never be, actual official, you know, powerful members of that Yakuza family.
And did you see at all what the reaction was of the general public when you were with the Yakuza, with these guys, when you're walking around?
They would kind of dismiss me very quickly, because in a way, to everyone, I always looked like some silly tourist who by accident is taking a picture of the Yakuza, and he doesn't even know that he's taking pictures of the Yakuza,
right?
You know?
No, I mean the Japanese public reaction to the Yakuza. Like, when they were walking down the street, what was the other Japanese, what was their reaction like?
Yeah. To the people who actually lived in Kabukicho, in the part that the family controlled, they would be extremely polite. They would be they would bow extremely deeply. They would be very, very, subordinate, and be very thankful when somebody of the Yakuza would, you know, talk to them. And other people, you would see the contempt in their eyes, because they wouldn't agree to what the Yakuza stands for, but they would never openly, show their disrespect.
Right.
They would always, obviously, you know, like, I think, again, like only a Japanese person can do, be extremely polite, and in that way show the way that you despise the person by being extremely polite. And I witnessed that obviously a few times, but again, something which I find unique about the Japanese culture, which is, I think, also a very, well, very unique thing again.
Yeah, only in Japan can they be extremely polite and hate you at the same time.
Yeah, and you actually understand that they hate you because they do that way.
Right.
When
right.
somebody is really polite, it still looks subtly different.
Right.
And I learned to, you know, to kind of see the difference by being there all the time, obviously.
And when you finished the project and you had the book published. Did you show them the book?
Yeah, they were the first people I went to, the first copies of the book of the, I personally went, flew back to Tokyo, and together with my brother presented, several copies of the book to the family, because of course that was, a token of respect to show them that I also had delivered what I promised that I would deliver, being right. a book. And I wanted, of course, to have their approval, that they liked the book. But, as we, you know, as we talked about earlier, that I always showed my pictures along the way. And I also showed my book being built along the way. So I would show them dummy books along the way with, you know, pictures, more pictures being added. There was no surprise as to what would be in there. The only surprise was the, you know, the quality of the book and the choice of the paper and stuff like that. Which they were pleasantly surprised with, that a Westerner would have that attention to detail. So I was, you know, I was happy that they liked it.
And so I'm curious now then, looking back on this project, what do you take away from it? I mean, it's interesting to me that you started this project to spend time with your brother.
Yes.
And I mean, of all the millions of things that you could have photographed in Japan, onsen, temples, you know, you picked one of the hardest things to photograph. So looking back, kind of what did you get out of this whole project?
Yeah, well, obviously, I did. I mean, so my brother and I now know that anything that we can put our mind to, or that we put our mind to, I'm sure we can accomplish, just because we are patient enough to go for it. I mean, who in their right mind would want to negotiate for 10 months with the Yakuza, not knowing if it would actually even work until the last minute? So I got obviously a lot closer to my brother in sense of working together in the future and doing more interesting things and stuff like that. So that is, I'm very grateful for that as well. And, the other thing that I obviously learned is what, you know, I am always very interested in different cultures and learning, about other cultures and, being open and having respect and mutual respect and, you know, learning things and stuff like that. And I did learn a great deal about Japanese culture, about Yakuza in particular, and about how they could treat me with respect, even though they didn't have to.
Right. And so your first printing sold out within like 30 days and you've released a second printing now. And if people wanted to buy this book, where can they do that?
They would just go to my website, antoncusters.com, everything, you know, in one go and with a K. And, there they can just, you know, buy the book. There is like a button on the homepage. But at the same time, my website is actually, well, I would think very interesting because it's in a diary kind of fashion that I describe what I feel while I'm taking those pictures or while I am in those situations. So for me, it's not the images of the Yakuza that are important, but the experience, what I had during the photographing, me being nervous, me not knowing what's going to happen, feeling excited, feeling angry, feeling sad, those kind of things. Which is what I think is what life is all about. And just by luck, I had a camera with me along the way.
That's fascinating. I am so interested in getting my copy of your book. If people want to find out more about that, it's antoncusters.com. And I'll post a link to that from my website at tokyopodcast.com. And thanks, Anton. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
You're so welcome. It was very nice talking to you too. And also talking about, you know, different things than only the photography, about what's behind the photography. I always think that's much more interesting. So I'm glad I could talk about that as well.
Thanks again to Anton for coming on the show and giving us an inside look into the life and work of the Yakuza. It's interesting that the Yakuza here in Japan are not quite as undercover as, say, some of the other organized crime units around the world. But then again, they're also not as open. I mean, I don't think many people really know what the inner workings of the Yakuza are like. You may see them, but you don't know what they actually do. And so his book does provide a very interesting look at the inside story of the Yakuza and how they go about their daily lives. So if you're interested in that, and as I said, like the photography is just outstanding in this book. So if you're interested in getting the book, visit his website at antoncusters.com. And I will post a link to his site and all the other websites that we mentioned on the show today on my website at tokyopodcast.com. Don't forget to visit my Facebook page at facebook.com/tokyopodcast or send me some feedback and comments on Twitter at Tokyo Podcast as well. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye. Like, how do they get their tattoos? Like, is every tattoo have a meaning? Like, something significant happens in their life, and then they go get a tattoo? Or how does that work?
It's kind of different. As far as I can tell, it works the other way around. So there are only a few Japanese traditional tattoo masters left these days. Excuse me. And so it's really, you know, with a stick with 4-pointed needles manually jabbing under the skin with different colors of ink. What I actually experienced is that what the tattoo is usually something that is significant for the person and not necessarily for the Yakuza family as a whole, but it is significant for the person, but it doesn't go as far as that the person is allowed to say what specifically or how specifically it would look like. So the person would talk to the tattoo sensei and say, look, this and this, I am this person, I experienced this in my life, and I have a wife and a kid, and I was born in the year of the tiger, and this and then that. And then the tattoo sensei would say, okay, I would propose to tattoo this mythical story on your back, and I'm going to do it this way, and that person cannot really decide what the tattoo master does, because the tattoo master is such a master that it's an honor to be tattooed by him. So there is no way that you can tell him how to do his craft. You can't tell him the general subject of what you want. And okay, you would like to have the tiger and the dragon fighting for the safety of the world. And he would say, okay, that's a good subject. It fits with you as a person, because he would have talked with you a couple of times. I will do this. And that's as far as it goes. And then, you know, he starts doing his job. And it would take about a year to complete a tattoo, about 100 hours. And you would have sessions of 2 hours per week with a tattoo master. And then your entire back and a part of your legs and a part of your arms would be tattooed.